You are listening to Social Europe Podcast. We discuss cutting-edge thinking on politics, economy, and employment and labour with some of the most thought-provoking people around, including Nobel Prize winners and other internationally acclaimed experts. So welcome and enjoy the conversation.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Social Europe Podcast, episode 37. My name is Henning Meyer, editor-in-chief of Social Europe. Today, I'm in conversation with Mark Blyth, professor of political economy at Brown University in the United States, about the crisis of globalization and connected political issues. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Hi, Mark Blyth. Thank you very much for joining me today to discuss the crisis of globalization and what kind of political and economic consequences it might have. Let me ask you the first question. Basically, do you think there is a crisis of globalization? And if there is one, in your opinion, what are its main characteristics?
So, it's always a tough one. I hate using the word crisis because I've been doing this stuff for about 30 years now. And when I went to graduate school, I read books about crisis. And then we had a crisis. Then we have another crisis, and a crisis of this, and a crisis of that. There's a danger that the term becomes meaningless. So I'll try and put it in a slightly different cast. Capitalism itself is usually quite a robust system. That is to say, it can not only deal with shocks, it can sometimes benefit from shocks. So depending on the type of shocks, I'll give you an example. In 2000, there was a huge equity bubble in what we called tech stocks. Those equities went to zero. All the investors in Cramer.com got creamed. Enron went bust, all that sort of stuff. But it didn't do too much economic damage to the wider American economy. And one result of that was companies called Global Crossing put hundreds and thousands of miles of fiber optics down and went bust. 10 years later, we get Netflix, which has revolutionized television around the world. So that's the way in which, you know, when it's working well, it's kind of robust to shocks. It could even benefit from that kind of Talebian anti-fragile way. Now, what's happened since 2008 is not the type of shocks that you're robust to, nor do you benefit from. You have a giant real estate bust, which tends to then accumulate through the banking sector and the bailout of the banking sector into a series of public debt bailouts, which then leads to greater fragility on that side. The entire financial sector on the private side, whether it's corporates through corporate debt markets or whether it's consumers through consumer debt, are extremely levered. Wages aren't growing, which is the real big problem. Inequality has literally never been higher in many cases. And we're finally waking up to the fact that there's an environmental crisis that is very, very serious and is going to hit us much sooner than we thought. So I look at it this way. We have 15 years to solve and really make a dent in a joint crisis. And that joint crisis is one of the environment and one of inequality, and the two of them are linked. And if we do that, then we could be in a much better place. And if we don't do that, this is the serious challenge that capitalism as a model has faced since its inception.
So basically, what you're saying is there has been obviously some very severe instability at the heart of the capitalist system. And what is well then described as a crisis of globalization is basically just a political expression of that crisis of capitalism?
Yes, but I mean, there's also something specific about globalization. And here's how I try to think about it. Earlier in my career, I spent a long time thinking about economic ideas and how they spread. And I'm hardly the only person that's puzzled over the spread of neoliberalism. But the more that I think about it now, the less that I think about neoliberalism as a set of ideas and more of a set of practices. And those practices are to liberalize, integrate, privatize, otherwise knock down barriers to competition, et cetera, et cetera. And when you do this with what were essentially national labor markets and national financial markets that were relatively closed, let's say homogenous states that looked the same, made the same stuff, and occasionally traded with each other, but kept their finances separate. Once you change that through the practices of neoliberalism and you become kind of one big market in the Poyanian sense of integrated finance and capital movements, etc., a couple of interesting things begin to happen. The first one is labor's ability to command its share of the surplus declines to zero. The strike becomes a meaningless weapon. Strikes decline to functionally to zero in the Western world, and you get prolonged wage stagnation because essentially all the surplus goes to capital. There's no reason for it not to. Particularly if you can say, for example, to German trade unions, I know that you guys are great and, you know, you're highly skilled and we do all that stuff and we talk a good game about skill formation, but you're not going to get a wage rise for 12 years because if you start agitating for one, you know the globalization starts 60 kilometers east of the Elbe. And if you don't shape up, we'll ship your jobs to Romania. So that's just the local version of a global story with American workers in China, et cetera, et cetera. So labor's ability to push up wages goes to zero. But there's also something interesting that's happened in financial markets and product markets at the same time. And it's kind of like the second order effect of neoliberalism, which is the following. We dumped about $17 trillion, yen, euros, and everything else we could get our hands on. And we're continuing to do so in Europe through QE-type programs, through central banks because of the financial crisis. And the weird thing is there's no inflation anywhere. In fact, Europe is still deflating. It hasn't hit its 2% target in almost a decade. So there's no structural inflation despite a massive, absolutely unprecedented monetary injection. So that's also weird. So then think about the third section, which is competitive product markets. Think about the price of a computer. Think about the price competition going on in all sectors. So if you look at what's called markup and margin data across firms, what you find, particularly in the US, but not exclusively, is that if you're a digital monopoly, you're making 50 to 60% profits. If you're a small, medium-sized firm and you're in global competition, your margins are tiny, your profits are tiny, and you're very resistant to push up wages because that literally could drive you out of business. So add this all together and you've got a very, very strange world that we haven't experienced before. One in which you're going to have structurally low interest rates because there's no inflation to combat. And we're seeing this with the Fed dialing back on this. Then you've got a world in which labor markets, you can have full employment, but it does nothing for wages, which means sustaining and perhaps making worse the inequalities that already bear there. And then in product markets, you have a kind of winner-takes-all dynamics, whereby quasi-monopolists get monopoly rents and everybody else gets the returns to perfect competition. And that seems to, in a very abstract sense, but in a very real sense, characterize a world we haven't been in before. And the consequences of thinking through that world are quite profound.
And you mentioned an interesting thing that I want to sort of tease out a bit more. Is do you see, because you're basically straddling the Atlantic, do you see any significant differences in how this pans out in the United States and how it pans out in Europe? What would you say is maybe specifically characteristic for the United States and what is a European thing?
Well, you know, let's start with the fact that, you know, Europe still has significant welfare states and welfare transfer. So if you look at Ireland, for example, which is a very small, unrepresentative country, admittedly, because it basically lives off American FDI stocks and then being a transshipment point into Europe. But Ireland has a very high pre-tax Gini coefficient, amongst the lowest when they do tax, when they do post-taxes. So government policy matters, and Europe still has policies. It actually wants to do something on climate change. It's finding out that the distributional politics of that, and in France in particular, are more tough than we thought. But there's effective governance and an attempt to basically deal with these agendas. In the United States, you have a governing class which is utterly in denial about the challenges that it faces. So in a sense, what you see in the United States is the most accelerated version of these pathologies. If you don't even accept that global warming and the consequences of climate change are real, it's very hard to do anything about it. And that's a big difference that we have at the moment between America and Europe. But at the same time, 30%, I believe, of Germany's electricity is still produced by coal. Poland is somewhere around the 60% mark. I mean, we're all talking a good game, but very few of us are walking a good game.
Right, and you also mentioned some of the sort of big tech companies, and if you look at sort of the discussion around digitization and what is likely to happen, I mean that stuff I'm looking at the moment. There seem to be two things happening. The one is that as these tech giants spread, they're using basically their quasi monopoly power in one sector to basically muscle into another. As far as I can see in the United States, there's a discussion about what kind of big tech company is going to disrupt healthcare next year, because that's a big share of GDP that is utterly inefficient in the United States. But at the same time, so basically market segmentations that used to basically shield or at least structure competition, they seem to be disappearing. And at the same time, you have user network effects that basically basically give these tech giants a big advantage to actually, you know, use these disappearing boundaries to go after after all sorts of different market segment or what used to be market segment. So I mean, are these inequality tendencies that are not least a result of this, are they likely to get worse before it gets better? Or what kind of policies do you think need to be implemented in order to address these issues?
Well, this is where Europe once again is disappointed, unfortunately. The whole point of GDPR wasn't about data protection. It was essentially scaring Facebook and Apple and the rest of them into paying some taxes. Basically saying, if every time that you switch on your platform, you have to click through 12 screens of approval, you know you're going to lose 80% of your users. Most of your business is data accumulation from your users, particularly on the Amazon and Facebook side of things. So you really need to wisen up and play ball. And it seems that with the intervention of the Dutch and the Estonians and a few others who love tech, that that's gone by the wayside. And we're going to have some kind of nominal taxation and they're going to be able to continue to do what they want. The truly damaging thing here with these companies is what they do to innovation. If you're running a startup company here, I was talking to someone yesterday about exactly this. The ambition for their company is to be annoying enough to be bought by Amazon. Then Amazon will do what they did in the 1930s with critical technologies such as beryllium and others at that point in time for steel, which is you simply put them on the shelf and you don't roll them out because you don't want the competition to ever get their edge. So this is all market preservation and killing innovation by buying it and putting it on the shelf. And this is exactly what monopolists do. Now, we're meant to know what to do with this. It's called bust them up, but there seems to be no political will to do this.
I mean, I heard a very good presentation by an economist the other day who basically came up with a theory why. I mean, the question is, what is the difference, say, between the current crop of internet giants or technology giants compared to the first ones? I mean, after all, Facebook wasn't the first social network. Google wasn't the first search engine. Nobody talks about Alta Vista anymore. And he came up with the idea that the difference is not just user network effects, but the underlying data, which basically, if you're just sitting on the biggest pile of data, your innovation costs, the marginal cost of innovation, are actually reduced by such an extent that it becomes completely inefficient and demoralizing for your competitors to even think about competing. So that basically then stifles innovation because it's concentrated in the monopoly power.
I mean, I would agree with that. I mean, I would go further then, but think about it this way. What exactly is the fuel for these corporates? It's our data. And we give it up for free because their platform is free, so we use their platform. Well, very simple then, charge for the platform. Make them charge for the platform and then watch the users drop off. Or have a free version versus a pay version. Or alternatively, even better, get people to individually license the use of their data to these firms. We auction off the digital spectrum to telephone companies. Why don't we auction off our personal data and basically give the data on a 10-year lease that's revocable? There's lots of things we could do. We just simply choose not to. That's the real commonality just now in governance. This is the bit that's truly disappointing. When I was younger, I used to think that the word leadership was crap, right? It was just one of these things that they bandied around business schools because that's how they made their money, selling basically hokum. And the older I've got, the more I've begun to realize that it really matters. And what really matters is that the quality of governance is down to the quality of the individuals who are running it. And think about Britain. Think about Brexit. I mean, there isn't a single person on either side of the aisle that I would basically want to trust with governing anything more than a high school. And then it would be a push. Right? The quality of political capital of the governing classes has just been eroded. And it's very clear to see why. There's no money in it. What you do is you jump into a party, you become well known for a couple of years, you then get some expertise, you parlay that into selling this into a selling opportunity with the private sector, and then you jump ship and work with the private sector. Consider that, for example, the New Labour front bench under Gordon Brown, the entirety of them went to work in finance, apart from one, Alan Millward, who I believe went to work for an American healthcare company that works on privatizing public services. So, you know, if these are the people that we've got in charge when we're trying to do this stuff, is it any wonder that there are tons of good ideas lying around and absolutely no way they get implemented? So there's a huge governance failure, which I think has to do with really with the quality of politicians that we have.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, if you think of Brexit or sort of a general idea of a populist backlash as one of the political consequences of what you could describe as a crisis of globalization, the world leadership is sorely missing, isn't it? I mean, if you, for instance, look at the Labour Party, they still can't get off the fence on Brexit, right? So how would they address the problem differently? I mean, they still come up with an idea of, you know, we would be able to negotiate a better deal, even though everybody says, well, that's simply not possible. Just listen to what you've been told, right? So
no, I know. It's kind of brilliant. I mean, you know, it would be funny if it wasn't tragic. So essentially, you have someone who keeps saying, I'm going to go get a better deal, despite being told that this is the only deal you're getting. Because when you leave a club, you don't get to change the rules. I'm sorry, that's that simple, right? Then there's the whole fantasy of the Irish backstop. Either you have a border or you don't have a border. You can't be half pregnant. And what they're looking for is a solution where they're half pregnant. And quite rightly, Europe turned around and goes, no, we're based on four freedoms. You don't get to compromise those in or out. So you've got one side that's trying to bargain for something which is impossible. And then you have another side that basically says, well, the one thing we know is they look bad doing this. So that's all we're going to do. We're just going to sit here and allow them to look bad. Well, shouldn't you be offering alternative leadership? Nah, it's a bit hard, mate. We won't be doing that one.
I mean, it's quite bizarre. I mean, only last week I saw David Davies on Question Time. I mean, bear in mind him being the guy who was whose job it was to try to negotiate part of the deal, right? And and he basically the basic misunderstanding is that everything is just being seen as tactical. So he basically said, well, if the EU27 now say, no, that's not going to happen. Oh, well, they have to say it, isn't it? It's the beginning of a negotiation. Well, no, mate, it's the end of a negotiation. And you just
exactly. Right? And you, like, there are four freedoms. They're constitutive of the very idea of Europe. They all hang together. This is why the Italian stance over migration and the Hungarian stance over migration is as big a threat to Europe as Brexit is. It's just that the Brits seem unable to actually process this or unwilling to process this.
I mean, yeah, the idea is always this has to be tactical because, I mean, it has to be just, you know, because you would.
Because it has to be.
Because it has to be, because you would start a negotiation with a tactical opening, right? But,
right.
You know, once they find out towards the very end of it, you know, there is no 11th hour deal on this, right? So,
no, and that, absolutely.
That's what really is
so
the real danger.
So basically, you've got this country which is piling towards a hard Brexit. Now, whether the Bank of England or anybody else really knows the long term economic effects will remain to be seen. But the one thing we know, if I was a currency trader, I know coming up in the middle of March is going to be an awfully good way of shorting the pound, right? We know that's going to happen. So it's not going to be pretty. There's going to be a devaluation. Imports will get more expensive. They'll have some import inflation. They'll have inflation through the import channel. That'll eat into real wages, which have already been stagnant. And the Brits will be even more pissed off despite voting for this themselves.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's move from this bad example of governance and leadership to, you know, ideas. I mean, at the end of the day, 2019 is also a year of European elections. Mm-hmm. So what can be done? So if you wanted to sort of come up or start with a policy agenda to address some of these issues,
the one thing we do want to do is not do that. And here's why. So this was the 2016 election, right? So in a sense, what we've run across the world during the globalization era is a kind of meritocracy. And the meritocracy is people like you and people like me and people who are slightly different from us, but nonetheless went to the same universities and studied the same courses. We get to run everything and we become the technocratic class. And the technocratic class really has nothing to do with the rest of society. We send our kids to the same schools, we read the same newspapers, we have the same social habits, and we're a kind of transnational class, right? I mean, I was part of this. I saw it emerging, right? Now, you've got everybody else who lives a very different life where wages aren't rising, their real-term costs are going up. The politicians are telling them there's no inflation, but it seems that the cost of everything nonetheless is going up for them in real terms. And there's a disconnect between the two. Now, go back to the story about globalization and how it emerged, right? The first thing that globalization, or the first thing neoliberalism did, in a sense, was to globalize labor markets and thereby render labor's ability to command its share of national income obsolete. Then you have that product market effect and it eats through product markets. So in a sense, what happened was all of the little cartel structures, corporatism in Germany,
let's think, product market coalitions, all that sort of stuff that kept the national economy insulated, right? All the little rules about who could buy your stocks on the stock market, etc. All of that was stripped away. And once all that was stripped away and everything really did go global, then you got a question as to what happens to the political party structures. Because what made all those little labor market cartels and cushy arrangements possible? What made all those product markets safe for domestic companies and all the rest of it? Were the political classes that mediated that post-war compromise that were based everywhere on either a two-party system, Labour and Conservative, or a majoritarian coalition system of the type that you had in Germany. Now, you've destroyed the labour market cartels, you've destroyed the product market cartels, you've globalised everything. What's the point of the existing parties? They don't really have one. They were there to stabilise structures that no longer exist, which is why they're strangely clueless about what's going on. So the thing we don't want to do is to say, well, let's hand it over to the technocrats. Let's get some policies. We'll have some policies. Senator Clinton had hundreds of policies. They were all ranked. You could see the RCT that they were scored against to prove that they worked. And we could just add them together, and that was a platform. Except it's not. Because what people are crying out for is a vision, a reason to believe in something. What they actually want is someone explaining them why, if global warming is so important, why they have to pay through their wallets through a diesel tax when people that own yachts seem to get off scot-free. What they need is somebody to explain to them why it is that inequality has gotten so out of whack and our politics is run by the very people who are sitting at the top of the pile pulling the strings of the politicians. They're not stupid. We think they're reading fake news. They're not. They're just looking for an alternative account because they don't believe a word that comes out of our mouths anymore. So until we actually get over the fact that the post-war party system is dead, populism is the new normal, that we somehow reconfigure political action to basically create new parties and new structures or renovate old parties and move forward with a much more progressive agenda, then we can talk about policies. But just simply going, what are we going to do in terms of policies? We tried that in 2016. It was a disaster.
All right. Okay. So policy is a second order issue at the moment. So we need a return of politics, if I understand you correctly.
Exactly.
And the institutional structures of existing parties are not really accommodating. So what would how would you reform parties? What would they need to do? Mainstream conservative, mainstream social democratic parties, under pressure everywhere, what would you recommend they should do?
Well, the first thing that they should do is to quote, I think it was Planck, the physicist that said this, that society evolves one funeral at a time. Let them die. Right? I mean, literally, the SPD at this point has no purpose. Nobody believes in it. The people who run it are septuagenarians looking after their own jobs. They have no real policies. They basically sucker whatever the coalition tends to be doing at a given moment in time, which is essentially hewing to the interests of the German business coalition. So I think you've got to start from scratch. I think at this point in time, if the SPD... when I had to give a speech at the Stiftung, the SPD Stiftung in 2016, I said you were two electoral cycles from extinction. And I think I was exactly right. You might get three, but they're dead. So there's no point trying to renovate something that's dead. Now, what you can do is you can do what Corbyn did, although he's not doing much with it, which is to take the dead husk of the Labour Party on a kind of free leveraged buyout, take it over, build a whole new membership, and then run it from the inside out. You might be able to do that, and I know that some young elements in the SPD want to do this. But another one would be, I'll ask you a pop quiz, because you know the answer. What's the fastest growing party in Germany just now?
Well, we know the answer to that one, but I mean, it's not.
It's the Greens.
Well, that might have petered out now a bit more recently. So,
It might be petering out, but at the same time, you've had this possibility in Germany, which you can never do—a red, red, green. Right? They've killed themselves over not doing this, and until you reassemble some kind of red, red, green coalition, you're not going to stand in the way of the nationalists.
Yeah, but I mean, it's an interesting point, especially about, you know, how should you react? I mean, can you name only one party that is sort of, or was reformed or came up as a protest party that has done anything substantial about any of the underlying issues, be it Podemos, be it Syriza? I mean, we talked about Corbyn and the Labour Party.
No, give him a chance. I mean, they were formed less than 6 or 7 years ago in some cases, right? So that's a bit tough. Second one is, well, what has Syriza ever done? Well, I don't know. It basically lived with an IMF blockade, so there wasn't much that they could do. So, you know, let's get a little bit real here. Why not ask the other question? Where were the parties of European social democracy when Greek pensioners were being hosed by the ECB in 2016 to make them back down?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, there's been a lot of discussion at the time about it. And I, amongst many others, thought there was a massive policy mistakes. Right. And I'm not denying that, you know, there are massive problems for mainstream social democratic parties.
And to say, you haven't achieved anything in the 10 years which you've been under the cosh. You're not worth anything. And maybe they're not. But my point is this, unless there is some kind of attempt to build a real encompassing centre-left and left and green coalition, we're done. Simply because the nationalists will take 30% every time and nobody believes a word the centre-left says anymore.
Yeah, I mean, all I wanted to say is basically that, you know, people seem to be looking for quick fixes because these sort of electoral support for populists is pretty fickle, right? So, and nobody has...
It's actually not. It's quite structural.
Is it?
So not to plug a paper, but if you have a look at just published in Government and Opposition, a paper by Jonathan Hopkin and I, one of the things that you'll find is what we call the populist crocodile, which is to say that right-wing populists in the South stagnate, but left-wing populists prosper. And in the North, you get the opposite. And they kind of cross and eat each other. But the populist vote share has been going up and up over the past 8 years and now averages 36% of the total vote.
Yeah, and what do you think what will happen once populists are in government? Say, look at Italy right now, right?
So this is the really interesting one. You're absolutely right. This is the fun one, right? So this is when the Italian thing came up and said, look, here's your real problem. It's not this government. It's what happens when this government fails. Because at the end of the day, what populism has going for it is the notion of sovereignty. And Chris Bickerton, political scientist at Cambridge, had a really nice observation about this in a book he did a few years ago called Member States. Sovereign states have their own print and press. They can devalue, they can default, they can do all these things. Once you join the euro, you can't. It's off the table. So essentially, you enjoy the backing of the ECB, who will back your sovereign debt and thereby backstop your credit markets, so long as you play by the rules. Hence the importance of rules in the system. But those rules really don't work for large consumption economies, large consumption-based economies like France, or particularly Italy. They work for the ones that can globalize their supply chains through Eastern Europe and then sell their stuff to the rest of the world and suck in demand from abroad. But that's Germany, the Eastern Europeans, and some of the North. So you have a real North-South split on this. So the populists will come to power in Italy. They may even come to power in France. And then they're going to find out, unless they leave the euro, there's not much they can do. But if they leave the euro, they'll destroy probably somewhere in the region of 40% of national savings while trying. That's not a good option. So you've now got people in charge who said, screw them all, we'll change everything. And they're not going to change anything. What does that do to democracy and people's faith in democracy?
Hmm. I mean, that's exactly what I wanted to get to, right? So the constraints are, in many cases, not just confined to, you know, the national circumstances. And even though the initial expression might lead to a populist government of sorts, without actually triggering a cataclysmic event, they won't be able to do very much about these issues. So,
right. So what happens is an electoral cycle one since the crisis. Whoever was incumbent gets thrown out, and whoever was, in a sense, the establishment opposition got in. Electoral cycle two, the establishment opposition, who is now the government, is voted out. Half the time, the old establishment incumbents in 2008 got back in, but then had to share power with populists. Or populists themselves massively increase their vote share, typically eating away at centre-left. So run the next electoral cycle, you will have more populism. More populism, more collapse of the centre-left going on, because it won't be able to reconfigure itself in any important way. And more of these people will get into power, and they will fail. And I really worry about that, because when they fail, we could say, well, good, because they're all idiots and they've got stupid policies. Yeah, but what does that do to the public's faith in democracy? Hmm. Because they're basically saying you can vote for the radical alternatives and you still don't get to change anything.
That's exactly the point. I mean, and that's why it hinges. So you've given up hope that there is some ways to reform, not just party structures. Party structures is just a function. But I mean, basically reforming the political economy, which is basically the constraint on many of these issues.
I think that it can be done if there is activism to try and do it. If basically remnants of the, let's say, progressive forces actually realize that unless they hang together, they will definitely hang apart. And we're really at that moment. And Germany is the classic example for this again. Like, if you'd have done red, red, green 6 or 7 years ago, we could have been in a completely different space now, but it wasn't done. And if you can reconfigure that now, you can offer an effective opposition to AfD. But if you can't, then you won't, because the SPD is dead. And that's a choice that's facing lots of countries.
Well, Mark, on that happy note, I think that's all we have time for today. It's a very cheerful end of the year.
let me finish on this. Right? Okay. You know, this is not a council of despair. I've zero faith in the incumbents. Right? They've had 10 years to fix it. They resuscitated the system with a massive liquidity injection. Didn't change anything, and it turns out the world has changed, and those structures don't fit anymore. Humans are incredibly adaptive, and when we're faced with crises, as we are, environmental and inequality, there can be various responses. Just now, what we see is the sort of the exclusionary nationalist response, but that doesn't have to be the only one. We are totally masters of our own destiny here. My point is this, if you're waiting for a bunch of superannuated septuagenarian social democrats to save your ass, start looking elsewhere.
Right. Okay. Well, we're going to see what's going to happen in the elections in 2019. There are quite a few important ones coming up. Obviously, we're also going to see how and if Brexit is resolved one way or the other. I mean, the default option has always been kicking the can down the road. Not sure it's
out of road.
Exactly. Yeah. So the can is still there, but the road might be at the
exactly.
end.
Exactly. The can's got bigger. The road's got shorter. Trying to fix this.
All right. Okay, Mark, thank you very much for joining me today, and I'll speak to you in the next year.
Absolutely. All the best. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you don't miss future episodes by subscribing to Social Europe Podcast. You can also read our articles on www.socialeurope.eu and follow us on Facebook and on Twitter @Social Europe. Until next time.